All right, it's time for me to put up or shut up, right? I've been saying things such as that even a simple thing like the formula of 1 plus 1 equals 2 has ontological and epistemological assumptions to it, and that they in turn are driven by some religious belief or other, that is, whatever assumptions one takes ontologically, epistemologically, are due in turn to what one regards as divine. That's a pretty wild sort of claim. So I promise to give you the reasons for it today and explain how it works. First of all, let's say that there definitely is a level at which 1 and 1 equals 2 for everybody. It doesn't matter whether you're a Buddhist, a Christian, a materialist, or a what. Sure, you add a column of figures the same way. But there are questions that can be asked about this formula, which are ontological and epistemological, and which mathematicians have long asked and tried to answer. First of all, what are these marks on this paper representing? What do those marks represent? What do they stand for? Let's call the marks on the paper numerals, and we'll say that these numerals stand for something else, and that the something else they stand for are numbers. Okay, what's a number? Now, if you want to really spoil the mathematics department Christmas party, you lean over the punch bowl and you say, what's a number? That may end up in a food fight, but people disagree wildly on the right answer to that. That's an ontological question. What are the realities that these stand for? And there have been people take many different positions, including that there are no realities that they stand for. Okay, but that's an ontological question. Here's an epistemological one. How do we know that the truth expressed by this formula is true everywhere and always? We treat it as though it is, right? We treat it as though it's been true no matter how far you want to go back in the past. We treat it as though it's true right now in the farthest distant reaches of the universe, and that it'll be true 10,000 years from now. How do we know that? I mean, what are the grounds on which to know that that's a truth that can't fail to be, no matter of time and place? It's always going to be true. So and now we have an ontological question, and then we have an epistemological question. The ontological question is, what do the numerals stand for? And the epistemological question is, how do we know? And not how do we know that it makes two this time, but how do we know it always did and always will? Now there's an ontological and an epistemological question. And if you think that how you answer those questions makes no difference to how mathematics is done, then you have a rude awakening coming. Let's take a look at how some people have answered the question. Let's take a look at how some people have answered the question. The first person I'm going to quote is Bertrand Russell, a mathematician who lived in the late 19th and first half of the 20th century. Russell thought about this kind of stuff. He was fascinated with mathematics, said it was one of the great loves of his life. And I have a quote here from Russell concerning this. Russell says, "Philosophers have commonly held that the laws of logic which underlie mathematics are the laws of thought, laws regulating the operations of our minds. By this opinion, the true dignity of reason is greatly lowered. It ceases to be an investigation into the very heart and immutable essence of all things actual and possible, becoming instead an inquiry into something more or less human and subject to our limitations. But mathematics really takes us from what is human into the region of absolute logical necessity, to which not only the actual world, but every possible world must conform. So Russell has it that math is reducible to logic, and logic is the realm of the absolute, absolute necessity. Logical laws are real, and they govern all reality. Math is a shortcut way of doing logic for Russell. And the logical laws are real things that govern all reality at the very heart and essence of everything. And they govern everything possible or actual. This reminds me, it's not that different from what Leibniz said when Leibniz was asked a similar question by one of his students. That's a name you probably remember, at least I hope. Leibniz and Newton invented the calculus at about the same time, independently of one another. And Leibniz was asked one time about this. How do we know, he was asked the epistemological question, how do we know that one and one will always be sure? And he replied this way. 1 plus 1 equals 2, like all other truths of mathematics, is an eternal and necessary truth that would not be affected even if the whole world were destroyed and there were no one to count and no objects to be counted. So for both Whitehead, for both Russell and Leibniz, the logical laws are real. Math is a shortcut way of doing logic. Logical laws are real, and the logical laws govern all reality with absolute necessity and are the heart and immutable essence of all things. That's very different from the answer given by another thinker, John Stuart Mill. Mill held the epistemological view that all our knowledge is derived from perception. So Mill held that we have perceptions, and then we generalize them, and we get math. You know what that means? It means that we see that often when we have one thing and another thing, we have two things. We see it often enough, we generalize it, say it's a law, and just treat it that way. Do we really know that one and one will always make two? Nope. Do we know that it always has? Nope. Do we know that it's doing that in the farthest reaches of the universe right now? Nope. All we know is that when we see it, it does, and we haven't seen an exception recently, and so we remain persuaded that it's a pretty good generalization, but that's all it is our generalization. Has nothing to do with the immutable heart and essence of all things, actual and real. It's just us cooking it up. Another thinker who also held that all we know are our own perceptions was Ernst Mach. This is a guy whose name you probably know without realizing it. Mach 1 is the speed of sound. Mach 2 is double the speed of sound. It was named for this fellow, Ernst Mach. He was known as the greatest atomic physicist prior to Einstein. Advocate of atomic theory and so on. What did Mach hold about this? One and one is two and all of mathematics. He said that all of mathematics was a game that we had invented. We set the rules. And if we follow the rules, the outcome is always what we say it's going to be because we made it up. It has no correspondence to reality. That's a hard one to push these days when it's mathematics that led us to discover dark matter and dark energy. What do you mean no correspondence to reality? Well, that's what Mach held, and he had to hold that, given that he thought that all we knew were our own perceptions. We certainly don't know anything called logical laws. Well, let's try another fellow, John Dewey. Dewey is one of the pragmatists of the early 20th century, William James and John Dewey. Dewey has this to say about 1 and 1 is 2. If meanings, ideas, concepts, notions, theories, systems are instrumental to an active reorganization of the environment, if they succeed in their office, they are reliable, sound, good, true. That which guides us truly is true. In other words, these things don't correspond to any reality. We try them. They're tools. They're instruments. If they work, they work. That's it. That's what we mean by them being true. We don't mean that we've got an eternal, changeless truth that's been true forever and will be forever. No, we just mean exactly what this says. If they're reliable, then they're true. Demonstrated capacity for this kind of guidance is precisely what is meant by truth. Is it? Can't you be guided by something that's in fact false and have things turn out well? I mean, it does happen, right? People trust the wrong set of assumptions. They act in a way that should have caused disaster. It doesn't. It saves them from disaster. Do we then say that the assumptions they acted on were true? No, we say they were false and you were lucky, man. But he says, no, that's all we mean by truth is that it turned out the way we hoped. And that's all we've got for 1 plus 1 equals 2, huh? Yep. For Dewey, it'd be silly to talk about 1 plus 1 equals 2 being true. It's a tool. It does something. He says that if it's instrumental to an active reorganization of our environment, you know, the way a shovel is. You have a shovel sitting on the wall in the garage. Is the shovel true or false? Neither one. It's a tool that does a job. Well, if the shovel does the job, if what you want to do is turn over the spade over your garden, it may work. If what you want to do is add up your checkbook, it won't work. It's not a pen. It's not good for that. It doesn't work for that. That's what he's saying. Whatever works. The view that people take of math has everything to do with how they use it and develop it. There was a fellow named Hippasus of Metaponium. He was sailing in the Mediterranean with a bunch of Pythagoreans. The Pythagoreans, remember, thought everything was made of numbers. So everything can have a perfectly set equation, perfectly regular. Their numbers are real objects. They make up the reality of things. He proved to them that pi, as far as we know, has no end. That there are numbers decimals that are indefinite, that just keep on going and going and have no definite end. And the Pythagoreans threw him overboard and killed him because he destroyed their theory of reality. T- Take Leibniz. Leibniz thinks that there's a real realm of things called numbers, mathematical truths. He said if you destroy the whole world, there's nothing left to count and no people left to count them, 1 and 1 will still make 2. It's there in the other world. What's the matter with that? Well, for one thing, it meant he had to deny negative numbers. If numbers are these real objects, what are negative numbers? Holes where there are no objects? There are no real negative numbers. So he rejected all that. He said, we write it that way on paper, but there really is no such thing. But that doesn't work. It's a negative. Many things have to be calculated with negative numbers. If you add up your checkbook and find you're $100 overdrawn, does that mean since there are no negative numbers, you're not really overdrawn? Yes, you are. I'm using silly little examples, but the examples extend to serious calculations. For example, there are also intuitionist mathematicians. One of the great ones was a man named Brouwer. Now, on the intuitionist view of mathematics, logic is part of language. It's not basic to math. Math is more basic than logic, says Brouwer. And things can be logical conundrums that shouldn't bother us at all in math. One of the things this led him to do was deny any proof. Here's a proof that looks like this. Either P or Q is true. If it's not P, then it must be Q. Brouwer says that's logic. That doesn't. We don't accept that. We don't accept any argument of that form. It also led him as an intuitionist to reject the entire theory of transfinite numbers as developed by Cantor. He said that Cantor's theory isn't even false. It doesn't rise to the dignity of being false. It's totally meaningless. There's a whole branch of math trashed. These are serious disagreements that these people have. Let me read you of what one scholar said who's a history of math, wrote a book on the history of mathematics. The current predicament in mathematics is that there's not one but many mathematics, and that for numerous reasons, each one fails to satisfy members of the opposing schools. It's now apparent that the concept of a universally accepted infallible body of reasoning, the majestic mathematics of 1800 and the pride of man, is a grand illusion. The present state of mathematics is a mockery of the hitherto deep-rooted and widely reputed truth and perfection of mathematics. Different ontology and epistemology are assumed, and they are driven by what each thinker regards as the independent, self-existent reality. For Leibniz and Russell, that's logic itself. For a guy like intuitionist like Brouwer, it's mathematics, not logic. For a person like Dewey, who's a pragmatist, it has more to do with a biological model. It has to do with the ultimate usefulness in preserving life. And it's an assumption that materialism plus biological evolution tells us all we need to know about a human being. And even drives conditions, limits the mathematics. So, if I object to all of them, what's left? I'm going to say that this reformational point of view is as a term that I'm going to use because of something that Calvin said about the scholastic view in rejecting it. I like it very much. So Calvin says, instead of the scholastic view, "It's vain for anyone to reason on the workmanship of the world except those who have learned to submit the whole of their intellectual wisdom," as Paul puts it, "to the foolishness of the cross. The invisible kingdom of Christ fills all things, and his spiritual grace is infused through all." So knowing Christ, knowing the true God through Christ, makes a difference not just to the supernatural level of the house, but the natural level as well. How? Well, for one thing, we don't take anything in that house to be uncreated. We don't assume that the laws of logic or mathematics are identical with the being of God. They're creations of God's. What math deals with is the quantitative properties of things. So it deals with the side of things that are real. Things have quantity every bit as much as they have spatial properties or physical properties or biological properties or logical properties. The laws that govern these kinds of properties are real. There are logical properties and logical laws. There are quantitative properties and mathematical laws. And they're real. So they do correspond to something real in things. They do correspond to the world as it exists, and it's been created by God. That there is real quantity is something that's basic even to logical sets. The symbol is a member of a set. It's the same as saying is a member, one member of a set. The existential quantifier in logic reads, "There exists at least one X such that," and then follows the description. So we can't do without quantity in math. And it's real. I mean, in logic, you can't do without quantity. And the quantity is what we're talking about when we talk about the mathematical side or aspect of things. Quantitative properties and laws are real. But they don't have absolute existence. They're created. And they're created relative to all the other kinds. In an integral creation that God has put together with all the kinds of properties and laws that are true of things around us and of ourselves. It's a different sort of view entirely, and the one that's extremely important and hasn't gotten much press. So I'm going to try to give it some more as we go on through with the rest of our discussions. 1 plus 1 equals 2, yep, for everybody. But then when you ask about a deeper understanding of it, some regard it as real, some regard it as uncreated and divine, some regard it as completely fictional, and so on. And the view that I'm advocating is that we take it as real, but created, and not identical with the divine creator at all. Our next session is going to be a general review. I'm going to call a halt, go back over everything. We've covered actually a lot of stuff in a short time. We've covered what theories are. We talked a little bit about their difference from myths. We talked about theories in philosophy being theories of reality or knowledge that are raised just by trying to make theories within sciences. Raises questions about how that science relates to all the others, and we end up with a general theory of reality, a general theory of knowledge. We looked at different ways that the people go at them. Then we looked at what a religious belief is. We looked at types of them. We saw them, how they related to one another with respect to how the non-divine depends on the divine. And then having covered that, we then went to whether religious beliefs have an important role to play in theory making, and I argue that they do, that they actually drive the ontological and epistemological assumptions of a theory, which in turn condition the theory. So that's a lot, and we'll try to go back over it very slowly and in a logical order and lay it all out for you again next time. We'll begin. That will be our session, a general review. So do some more reading. Read back over it. Be prepared. And the review will be of great benefit to you.